Hi, you're listening to iiPod, the official podcast of the Duke Lemur Center in Durham, North Carolina.
I'm Matt Bortz, curator of fossils at the Duke Lemur Center.
And I'm Megan McGrath, education programs manager at the Duke Lemur Center.
Hi, Megan.
Hi, Matt.
It's been a minute.
It has been a little bit of time since we've done anything with the podcast or obviously been able to release an episode. Do you want to tell people why that is?
Yeah. So in the last year, since we released our season on rough lemurs, a lot has changed, especially in the United States, when it comes to the way research funding is awarded. And so the Lemur Center is partially supported by folks coming to actually do tours and buy things in the gift shop. It's partially supported by Duke University. And it's partially supported by federal research grants and foundations that support us. And so the federal support from the U.S. government, especially from the National Science Foundation, has been especially hard to come by in the last couple of months. And so that's meant a pivot for a lot of folks at the Lemur Center to finding other ways that we can find ways to support our programs. So foundation support has become really important, really interacting a lot more with donors. And that also is true of Duke as a university. The university itself runs a lot on federal funding. And so Duke has been less able to support the Lemur Center on the scale that I think the university would prefer to. And so that means everybody has needed to put on a couple more hats to figure out how to keep our programs going. We are here. We're doing fine. But it means that sitting down to record this podcast with you has been harder to find time for. To that end, we're going to be changing a little bit about the way we release and what we talk about and how we can help produce this a little more rapidly and hopefully also provide content that is engaging for our listeners that's really kind of grounded in what we do at the Lemur Center.
Yeah, absolutely. So this time away from the podcast has given us time to really brainstorm and think, what do we want to do differently? And one of the things we want to do differently is give you more updates about just what's happening at the Lemur Center with our conservation partners in Madagascar, at the museum, in the collection. And so we're hoping that with this new format, we'll still have occasional interviews with really interesting and cool people, but we won't be as limited as we were before on what subjects. And we can come up with, hey, this cool thing's happening at the Lemur Center this month. Let's talk about that.
There's a lot going on a given day in our lives at the museum, in the lives of the keepers who are working with the animals, and with the animals themselves. The animals have a lot that they need to work out amongst each other, and it becomes really fascinating soap opera kind of stuff sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. So we figured we would kick off with things that are happening right now with the lemurs themselves living at the Duke Lemur Center in North Carolina.
And just so listeners know, we're having this conversation in late September of 2025.
We are actually heading into our off season here at the Duke Lemur Center. So I know what that means for those of us working more closely with the living lemurs, but does that mean anything here at the museum? Does that change any operations for you?
I think the main change is we start interacting more with students that are on campus. I do a lot more mentoring of independent research projects for students that are coming in. And we still have visitors that come to the collection to do research on the fossils and bones we have. But because they are mostly academic researchers themselves, they have classes to teach. And so we see fewer people coming to work in the collection. Summer is kind of the high season for us, when we have a lot of visitors that are kind of rotating through to try to collect data before they go back to teaching classes. So there's this shift in kind of going facing towards the students. We have high school students coming from the School of Science and Math at the street that'll be coming to visit soon. Like, there's all that kind of outreach in a different way that we have to do during our shift to a different season. How about you?
So just like here at the museum, our high season is definitely over the summer. So we say usually May through September is our tour season. And now as we're heading into the off season, the main thing that changes on site at the Lemur Center is where the lemurs need to live for them to be happy and healthy. And so that means that we have lemurs moving into housing that is more cold weather friendly. And that means we don't have them out in the forest as often. We don't have them out on our summer tour path since there's no indoor spaces for them to go into. And so that means that all the tours we can offer change because we base everything we do on site at the main campus around what the lemurs need and how they need to live. And so we're changing up our tour offerings. We bring back wild workshops, including one that Matt here is going to be leading involving the fossils.
Extreme evolution.
Yes. And so there's lots of cool things that come up, but generally our visitor numbers go down, which is tough, because kids are going back into school. So we try to cram in as many field trips as we can before we get to that season. But one really interesting thing about this time of year is that we're also in testing season for the animals who free range or the lemurs who live out in our natural habitat enclosures in the forests.
So we've talked about the ways the animals can live at the Lemur Center before, but maybe kind of bring it all into one place. So if I'm a lemur at the Lemur Center, what are the different kinds of places where I might be set up for my home?
If you're a nocturnal lemur, your options are a little different. You're going to have mostly indoor space. Eyes do get some outdoor space during the warmer months of the year, but you're going to be on a reverse light cycle. So we need to keep you indoors so we can control that light cycle. You have nighttime during our daytime. You have daytime during our nighttime. That way, you're going to be awake during the hours we're there to check in on you, take care of you, look after your well-being. And as a bonus, guests get to see them as well. And also with our smaller nocturnals, they're just very small, and a black rat snake does not know the difference between a gray mouse lemur and a mouse. So we have to be more careful about how we house them.
I always feel like I need to clarify with people, like mouse lemur is a very literal term. Like they
Yes.
really are that small.
Exactly. And so if you are a diurnal lemur or a lemur who is active during the day, you're going to be a bit larger bodied in general. And so in the summertime, you have the option of maybe living on our summer tour path in converted old corn silos that have been outfitted with branching and tree trunks and all these fun things to climb on and see so many of our visitors. Thank you if you came out to see them this summer. You also might live in our year-round housing or something we sometimes call our winter housing because it's cold weather friendly. And that is going to be more in the style of expandable and contractible rooms for the lemurs, both indoors and out. So we've got fencing surrounding different enclosures that we can expand. If we have a family of five, we can have five outdoor rooms and five indoor rooms to match. Or if that family goes down to two, the kids move out, we can kind of contract that down, make space for other lemurs. It also gives us the ability to shut doors between them so that if we want to do training sessions, research sessions, if someone's not feeling well, we have the ability to kind of move the lemurs around a little easier and look after their well-being a little bit more easily. And then if you meet certain criteria, you could live in a forest habitat. And that is going to be our natural habitat enclosures. We call those animals free rangers. So if you hear that term a lot, you'll also hear us say the word NHE. That's an acronym for natural habitat enclosure. So free rangers get to live out in NHEs, and that means they spend their daytime hours out hopping around, walking around, leaping around, snoozing in trees. So we have chunks of forest that are enclosed by specialized fencing to keep certain groups of lemurs in certain patches of forest.
And I think that there's some sense of people visiting that the NHEs, because they are open forests, it's like, why not just like have all of the forest connected? So why not?
Great question. So actually, from what I understand, in earlier iterations of our NHEs, the free-ranging lemurs were in a big giant patch of forest, and you certainly got a lot of natural behavior, but there was a higher incidence of things like injuries from fighting and other things like that. There's also less control over who's breeding with whom in those circumstances, which is important for us managing our population and the Association of Zoo and Aquariums' general population of these lemurs. The decision was made to kind of do smaller chunks of forest so that we could better control those factors, because I like to joke that it's like glamping. We're not trying to make the truly wild experience here because the wild is wonderful and beautiful, but also harsh. Like, we need to remember that. So, an injury can quickly turn into an infection and possible death for an animal in the wild. We don't want those kinds of factors going out of control at the Lemur Center. So, we like to have slightly smaller groups than in the wild. We definitely don't have more than one group of a species in a forest together because that's a recipe for basically fighting every day.
Yeah, I feel like that's an especially important piece of that. Where like if you go to Madagascar, you're not going to see a troop of ringtail lemurs as close together as you would see at the Lemur Center. Like there are multiple troops that they would be very far apart. We don't have enough of deep forest to let them push into right now. And so the fencing between them does help us have multiple groups where we can have all these different families that have enough space for their troop, but also aren't going to decide they want more and then attack someone nearby.
Yes, absolutely. And we have about a 10-foot gap between bordering forests that allows for some great natural behavior, especially between the ringtail lemurs. I like to call it trash talk o'clock, where the ringtail lemur troops will kind of sidle along each side of the fence and stare at each other across that 10-foot gap. And the males will do their stink fighting behavior that we learned about in our ringtail season. So they get to practice the light version of those natural behaviors, but we never progress into the, harsh version as often.
Yeah, I think of it as West Side Story. It's a lot of dancing and not actual knife fighting.
Yes, absolutely. The musical version.
Yeah, musical version.
Let's actually back up further and talk about which lemurs get to live out in the forest, right? That's a big question that we get, is why does this lemur get to live out here? Why doesn't another lemur? So there are rules for free ranging. There are rules for who's allowed to live where. And the rules for free ranging are, one, you have to get along with the other lemurs living in your forest. That's your own family group. If you have another species out there, you have to at least be, kind of ignoring your neighbors at the very least. And they usually don't interact much. Typically, we have, say, ring-tailed lemurs and cockerel chafak together. They do really well together in the forest. Ruffed lemurs can be problem children. Getting along with your neighbors is important. That also includes us coming into the forest, tour groups coming through. We like our lemurs to be human neutral, so they don't really care much where we go, what we do, as long as we give them a respectful distance of about 6 feet. They don't really mind us going in there. So that's rule number one. Rule number two is you've got to be in good enough health. So if you're getting older and let's say your balance is not what it used to be, we don't want to worry about you 60 feet up in a tree, and worry about what's going to happen. If you need medication at certain hours of every day, the forest isn't going to be the best habitat for that animal. So their health does factor in. And then the last rule is that they got to follow the rules. So the rules for living in the forest are you got to stay within the boundaries. That is a 6-foot fence that's topped by a net. That net has a light electrical pulse that feels like a bee sting, just enough to say, I don't like that, and stay back on the other side. And then we also keep the trees cut back on either side of the fence. So there's not an easy route to leap over top of the fence. There also is a routine for coming in at the end of the day to ensure they're sleeping in more secure overnight housing. And that means literally a dinner bell gets rung every single day, between 2 and 3 in the afternoon, usually. And once that dinner bell is rung, the animals come right in. They know that that dinner bell means their favorite snacks and their full meal for the day. This time of year, though, it gets tricky because we've got a forest full of muscadine grapes and acorns, and those are tasty lemur snacks.
The forests that are in the NHEs aren't transplanted species that we find in the forests of Madagascar. They are loblolly pines. They are tulip poplars. They are the things that we find in central North Carolina. And it's really fascinating that the animals are able to forage on stuff that they find in North Carolina. There are parts of Madagascar that aren't that different when it comes to kind of ecoregion from where we are. So it's not surprising that there are plants that produce similar nuts, similar seeds, similar flowers, similar leaves that the animals also like to eat. Like that's just how evolution works. You find like similar things adapt to similar habitats. And so muscadine grapes and acorns are things that lemurs like to eat, and they do very well with them.
Absolutely. And what I find fascinating is the fact that these lemurs are living so far away from what their native habitat would be. To be clear, these lemurs have never lived in Madagascar, but they are still able to understand what they should and shouldn't eat instinctually, which is fascinating in an evolutionary sense, right? Is like, how many animals do we think we could pick up and plop in a new environment and they would instinctually know what they should and shouldn't eat? And how much of that is particular to the certain set of adaptations and skills that lemurs and primates have?
How much of that is watching what mom does? How much of that, which is part of why free ranging is so important. There is this socialization that happens when mom and baby and older sibling are all hanging out watching what each other are doing. And that's part of the learning process, along with some trial and error. They're probably eating a lot of things that taste gross. And they say, like, well, I don't want that anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And the really cool thing about the forest habitats, those NHEs, is they do so much of our work for us. A lot of what we do caring for these animals, caring for this genetic backup population, ensuring their well-being is making sure they don't get bored, making sure they have ways to express their normal behaviors, their wild behaviors, what makes lemurs lemurs. And so when they don't have forest habitats, our workload goes up. Only about a third of our animals can free range at any given time just because of the constraints of space and rules and all those different things. So it's like a giant puzzle for our curator to figure out who should live where and who gets to live in this forest habitat this summer. The forest is its own enrichment. The lemurs can jump, play, swing, nap wherever they would like to. They can use those noses and sniff out good spots to forage. They can engage in really weird, unique lemur behaviors like geophagy, where they'll snack on some dirt if they want to, if they are sensing some mineral content maybe that they'd be interested in. And so they really are pretty magical places. And they also honestly make our lives easier if we can get the lemurs out there.
So, preparing an animal to learn the rules requires a lot of training. What does that training look like for these animals?
So we have our curator of animal behavior and welfare, Meg Dye. Basically, her whole job is figuring out these kinds of plans, and they can be tailored to individuals, but the general idea is that the animals are first introduced to the idea of just leaving their home enclosure. So just we have a hallway that we open up, a fenced hallway outside of their enclosure that leads basically through a fenced tunnel to the forest. We can walk through it and the lemurs can walk through it. And so some lemurs need a lot of help just being encouraged to go out into that hallway. That's unsearched territory. That's newfound turf for them. They're not really sure about it. If they have a family member who's done it before, they might be more brave because if mom's doing it, then it feels safe and I might do it too. Or if they're both brand new, it might take a little encouragement. So that might include like literally baiting them with treats, maybe their favorite snacks or dried fruits or nuts, and saying like, hey, the hallway's not scary. Let's practice coming out here. And then it also includes pairing that bell I mentioned with their favorite snacks. So you want to make sure, like the Pavlov's dog analogy, you want to make sure every time they hear that bell, they are conditioned to understand, ah, that bell means if I go inside, if I go into my nice, safe indoor enclosure, I'm going to get my favorite snacks. And so we make sure we're constantly pairing that bell with their favorite snacks as we progress. And then once we're comfortable with the hallway and we recall really well back into their indoor space with that bell, then we might start venturing out into the forest for small chunks of time. And with some animals, they might take to the trees immediately. With others, a little bit of encouragement might be required. We'll do things like build bridges so that they can go up high into the forest right away if they're not comfortable on the ground and the ground is spooky for them. And then once they start consistently being comfortable going out, we expand that length of time. We've got a team of staff and wonderful experienced volunteers who help us observe the animals. How long they need to be observed constantly depends a bit on the group. If they're old, like pros at this, probably not much, versus maybe they have a new baby in the family who's maybe prone to getting left behind by the rest of the family, and they might need observation for a bit longer. So it kind of caters to each individual group. That whole process could take a matter of weeks, could take a matter of months. It really depends on the individuals. And there are kind of checkpoints along the way of, ooh, they seem to really hate going outside and we're not making much progress here. Maybe going into the forest isn't the best fit for this family and someone else would like to go. Or maybe they're a little too comfortable going out into the forest and they keep shooting out and leaving their young infant behind. Maybe we need to keep this family more together for a little longer.
So right now we're in testing season. So what does that mean? So they've done all this training to like get out into the forest. Now what's happening?
So now that we're in testing season, we're in the time of year where the temperatures are going to start dropping too low for lemurs to be out in the forest, especially overnight. And so we have all these complicated parameters. There is an actual flow chart that has so many pieces to it that determines in the winter, do the animals get forest access? Do they not? What's the temperature at 10 a.m.? What's the temperature overnight? What else is going on in the family unit? So just know that part is complicated, but the testing period ensures we know we can rely on these animals to follow their training, especially since, as we mentioned, we're in muscadine grape and acorn season. So when you've been gorging on really tasty snacks in the forest all day, your motivation for your usual favorite treats may not be as high. But we need to know that if we have a nice, really warm stretch of days in December, we can trust you to go out into the forest, enjoy your time in the forest, but then come back before we get to freezing temperatures later in that week. Because if the lemurs hold up 80 feet in a tree, we have limited options for how to get them back. So we need to really trust that relationship with that training. So the testing period is a period of time in September and October where we designate a stretch of days where we need 100% reliability from these animals doing what we call lockup or recall. So this means that when that bell is rung, those animals within 1 hour of that bell being rung are going to come in and consistently follow that training routine. We give them an hour. Maybe they're a little slow moving. Maybe they are a little full of acorns that day, but we want them to reliably come in within that time frame. And if we have trouble getting them in, if our animal care staff have to go into overtime, really bribing them, ringing the bell over and over, then that animal probably won't be allowed to free range during the winter months, which sounds really harsh, but That is what we have to do to avoid risking frostbite, serious injury, anything else, because the one big difference between our habitat and the habitat where all of our lemur species would be found in Madagascar is that it doesn't get below freezing in those areas. And lemurs are not very good at dealing with freezing temperatures. So testing period means for, I think it's 18 days straight, you need 100% reliability. Otherwise, you might get grounded for the winter.
And I feel like that recall testing is especially important now because of this variability in the weather, but it's also really important reinforcement throughout the year because weather changes rapidly. I know that we can have sudden storms that sweep in that can cause trees to come down, that like instant recall or near instant recall is a really important part just to keep the animals safe, especially during hurricane season where things can flare up pretty quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why we have to be really particular about which animals go where and why the training part of getting the animals out into the forest is the bulk of our work. Once they're conditioned to the forest, great. The forest is doing a great thing for us. We don't have to worry about anything. But we really rely heavily on that really regimented training and the systems that we have in place to ensure that they are safe in case of unexpected weather events. We this summer had some really dry weather and had some fires pop up in the Duke Forest, thankfully far enough away from us. But I recall one day where there was a fire within a mile of the lemur center. And as soon as we got notification of it, our animal care team went right out and we had 100% recall, I think within 15 minutes of having that happen. And so being really strict with our training routines means we can trust that our lemurs will be safe when unexpected things come up.
And now for some lemur news. One of the things that we would like to make a part of the iiPod is giving listeners an update about what's going on in the colony, kind of what political machinations are taking place, who's in charge, who got kicked out, who is a new baby that's making adorable faces. And so, do you have any updates from the colony that relate to what's been going on in the NHEs?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think a great one to talk about would be our red-ruffed lemur family. So I'll give you who they are first. So that's Ruby, the mom, Buzz, the dad, and then there are twins who are a few years old named Kit and Hubble. Kit is the female. And then we have new kid on the block, Spock, who was just recently named actually by a team of education volunteers who banded together to be name adoption donors, which is really exciting. And so that family has recently been going through a little bit of trouble as Kit and Hubble are getting older and Ruby and Buzz are kind of asserting their dominance and Spock is getting used to things. So earlier this summer, the family, we know this happens with ruffed lemurs, the family was just kind of heading straight out into the forest and kind of leaving little Spock behind because ruffed lemurs do not carry their babies on them. They keep them in nests until they're big enough to move around. And so we have to wait longer for the ruffed lemur babies to get bigger. And then once they're ready to go out, we have to watch really carefully because the family tends to just leave Spock behind, either heading out into the forest or coming back from the forest. And so there's been a couple of days where we've had to lead the family back out to their own kid in the forest and say, "You forgot something," and then have everybody come back in at that recall time. But we've worked out the kinks, so to speak, in that. Now, the latest interesting thing that's happening behaviorally is that as we head into the changing season, Buzz has started kind of really asserting dominance over Kit, which is really unusual for a dad to be asserting dominance over a daughter. And so that's been an interesting thing for the team to navigate. And we're basically at a bit of an armistice right now in the family dynamics where Ruby, Buzz, and Spock, their youngest, go out into the forest together and rotate out there together. And then on alternate days, Kit and Hubble are able to go out into the forest. And then on the third day, we have Buzz hang out by himself for a chunk of time of the day. And then Kit and Hubble are able to visit with Ruby and their youngest sibling, Spock. The reason we're doing all of this complicated stuff is because Buzz has made it clear he doesn't get along with Kit anymore. But Kit and Hubble are still in that stage of life where it's really helpful for them to have experience with an infant and for them to know what is an infant? How does my mom interact with an infant if I were a parent one day? And so all this social learning we mentioned earlier of knowing what's okay, what do I do in the world is really important for lemurs. And so I think it's a great example of the kind of complicated family dynamics and the hoops the animal care team kind of have to jump through to ensure long-term well-being of the animals, not just short-sighted what makes them happy right now, but also what makes them successful parents in the future, what gives them a fully enriched, full understanding of the social behavior of other lemurs and sets them up for success in the future. So that's a bit of lemur family drama that's been going on recently. Now let's do some fun facts.
So, Megan, What are your fun facts for this episode?
I was recently doing a program with our director of research, Dr. Aaron M. Key, and it never ceases to amaze me how I'll suddenly just learn something completely new that I feel like I should have known after almost 10 years of working around lemurs and learning as much as I possibly can about lemurs. And so I learned from Dr. Aaron M. Key that ring-tailed lemurs not only have different scent glands on different parts of their body, but the chemical composition of those scent glands is different and works together. So let me backpedal a little bit and explain some context for why this fact is really cool. Ring-tailed lemurs, like all lemurs, do lots of scent marking, but they specifically do a lot of scent marking that involves them kind of pulling their forearms up to their shoulders and kind of rubbing two scent glands together, and then either rubbing their forearm over their tail and doing the classic stink fighting or stink flirting behavior, or dragging a spur they have on their forearm over wood and kind of gouging it out and leaving their scent embedded and behind. So this is a very common ring-tailed lemur scent behavior, one that we see all the time from the ring-tailed lemurs. But what makes it really cool is that the secretions from the scent glands that are by the spur on the ring-tailed lemur's forearm and by the other scent gland kind of up near their shoulder blade area are very different from each other. And so the secretion by the spurs on their forearms is very potent and very, very stinky, essentially. Smells really, really potent, exactly like this particular lemur. But what it has in potency, it lacks in staying power. So it's very evaporative. It's basically more similar to like an alcohol-based substance where it's just going to evaporate really quickly, has no staying power. So if you're trying to mark an area, especially like a tree branch or something, it's not the most effective thing on its own for staying power. But the scent gland that is on their shoulders, their kind of chest area, is, I'm so sorry to have to tell you this, more the consistency of like toothpaste with what it secretes. So it's a pretty gross analogy.
I really don't like that.
I'm sorry. But the cool thing about this is that within that secretion that comes out of their kind of chest shoulder glands is more chemical properties like squalene, which is something that's used a lot in human skincare products or a derivative is. And so basically things that are more moisturizing, things that have a little more staying power and will stick around for longer. And so every day for almost 10 years, I've watched ring-tailed lemurs walk up to something and kind of rub their spur into the scent gland that's on their chest and then drag their spur across this wood or whatever structure to try to gouge it out. And what I haven't known is that they are instinctually mixing the more potent scent that's on their forearm with the staying kind of moisturizing power, squalene-loaded cells that are coming from their scent gland on their chest so that their scent is not only potent but lasting longer and staying in their environment for longer, which is just really cool because basically ring-tailed lemurs are doing a little chemistry experiment every day when they're scent marking.
Yeah, that's like the little perfumery. It's like little walking, like a little bit of this and a little bit of that. Like I mix it up. Which I guess I do they always mix them, or when they're stink fighting, or do they just use their forearms to like just kind of, because it's like, hey, I'm here right now.
So, great question. What I've seen when they're intentionally scent marking something is a lot of like, as they investigate a branch, you'll see them. I'm going to try to explain it, but it's basically like they stand on their back legs and they kind of hunch over and sniff whatever it is. And you'll see them kind of just start pulling their arms into their chest. And you might even miss what they're doing because it just kind of looks like they're like squeezing their arms in for a second and they're kind of mixing those scent glands together. Or if they're stink fighting, you'll see them kind of quickly do that. But I have seen them stink fight by just dragging their forearm over their tails and their tails through their arms. So I'm wondering if it's a more short-term immediate need that they're just getting the tail stinky in the moment and then waving it over. But I don't honestly know the full answer to that. That's just based on my anecdotal observations.
Yeah, that's cool and gross. Both can be true. Often are when we're talking about animals.
Yep. Matt, what have you learned? Is it as gross as what I learned?
No, because it's very dead. Because that's a lot of the fun facts that I learned. So things that I learn about are often like millions of years dried out. So that's nice. So this is a research article that came out relatively recently that was co-authored by a whole bunch of people, but the lead author was a woman named Carrie Mongold, who's at Stony Brook University. And it's the description of the hand of an animal called Paranthropus boisei. Paranthropus boisei is the name of a early human-like creature that was walking across the landscape of Eastern Africa like 1.5 million years ago. This animal was found like in the 1950s by Mary Leakey and Lewis Leakey. When it was originally found, it was found as a skull. And it was a skull that was found in the same horizon as a bunch of tools. Like they were like stones that had been broken open. And so from looking at the skull, it was clear that the spinal cord came out of the skull downwards. And so like, this is an animal that is upright on two legs. And so there's a hominin, which is the name of like all the bipedal apes, including our direct ancestors and then relatives that we have. And originally in the 50s, there weren't a ton of human relative fossils. And so everything was kind of getting put into our family tree. As more and more fossils of walking apes have been found, we've started to realize that our like immediate ancestors and relatives kind of are very bushy. Like there's a lot of diversity. Once walking on two legs is something that apes and primates figure out, it's just like, holy, we can do all kinds of cool stuff here. And so there's a lineage that are living kind of in parallel to us. Like there are closer to direct ancestors are animals that are in the genus Homo. So we are Homo sapien. And then that they're living 1.5 million years ago. And living in those same landscapes are this other group of animals that are called paranthropines. And paranthropus means like close to man or close to us. And they are weird compared to us. Like the skull that Mary and Lewis Leakey found have like giant teeth, like the big chewing teeth at the back of the jaw are like the size of like nickels on a skull that is like the size of kind of like your two fists balled up. Like it's a small animal, kind of chimpanzee size creature, that then has these giant teeth and huge chewing muscles. They have this like mohawk of bone that goes down the middle of their skull that is big attachment sites for huge chewing muscles. So it was found though with tools. And there's this like assumption, like maybe Paranthropus, the Boise eye, is the tool maker. And so this original skull is like stained this really dark black. It's called the black skull. It's this very cool thing that, like, I don't know, it's just beautiful as an object, and as a creature. But looking at this giant, giant teeth, giant jaw attachment site, it's like, why does this animal need tools? It's like its tools are in its head. Like that's how it's breaking things down. People start to sample things like what it was likely eating. They're taking stable isotopes out of it, like what kind of carbon it has, what kind of oxygen. And they're coming out as very, they eat a lot of plants, they eat a lot of tubers. And it seems like they're really just like chewing them up. And so it's like, could this animal make tools? Was kind of the question. The problem was, we didn't have any of its skeleton, or like we weren't sure what the skeleton of Paranthropus looked like. There wasn't kind of a Lucy style, like, here are all the pieces you need for Paranthropus Boisei, or at least until recently. And so this description, this research paper describes the first hand that has been associated, like the most complete hand that's been associated with this crazy, like nutcracker-like jaw structure. And the hand is a toolmaker's hand. Kind of. It is a more delicate hand that is capable of more kind of diversity in the way the fingers can articulate than a gorilla or a chimpanzee. Like it is something that is more like our hand. It's capable of some of the grips that we can do. It can pinch its hand together. So it's basically capable of making like holding a rock and smashing another rock and getting a flake out of that. So, but it's not going to do like really detailed work with this hand. But then there's also some parts of its wrist that are reminiscent of gorilla hands. So it's this interesting kind of middle ground. It's like I said, as we learn more about the bushiness of our relatives, this is not a direct ancestor to us. And it's always been this weird world to contemplate that has like multiple tool making-ish, like larger brained walking apes all kind of exploring the landscape in parallel. It's like, how do, like, we are the only creatures like us, but there was a time when there were other creatures kind of like us. It was like living in a world where like aliens were walking by, whereas just there's a whole different way of encountering the world with a similar tool set that we have. This was like a quest that's been going on for, over half a century to find like what were these tools that were found near the black skull, something that Paranthropus Boisei was capable of making. And based on the hand, it's possible. Now, the problem with tools and the problem with skulls is like often the way these things get put together. Like you can never like say this skull that was preserved at the same layer as these like stone tools over here were made by like this animal. But it doesn't disqualify the ability of this animal from being able to manipulate its environment in a way that is more human-like than we might have thought.
Thank you for tuning in for this episode of iiPod.
This podcast is brought to you ad-free by the Duke Lemur Center.
If you'd like to learn more about the Duke Lemur Center's work in research, education, and conservation, or even schedule a visit to see the lemurs
or the fossils
in Durham, North Carolina, go to lemur.duke.edu.
All that we do here at the Lemur Center is only possible with donor support. If you'd like to support us, you can visit lemur.duke.edu/donate. And with that, thanks for Matt
and Megan
and all the primates at the Duke Lemur Center.